people can come up to the table instead of sitting toward the back. We don't have a huge crowd this morning. Welcome, I'm Ken Kirky, Director of Planning and Research with the Association of Bay Area Governments. This is the Regional Advisory Working Group. We have a couple of items today. One is what was to be a panel discussion and has turned into a keynote speaker discussion. Karen Engel let us know this morning. She had an emergency came up, and unfortunately she's not able to be here, but we are fortunate to have Jeff Levine from the City of Oakland, housing expert extraordinaire, who's going to talk with us. And hopefully you can engage in this conversation around a number of affordable housing issues and policies as we work to implement the plan going forward. Before we get to that, I just wanted to catch people up. If you haven't been following super closely where we're at in the development process for the Sustainable Community Strategy and the Regional Transportation Plan, otherwise known as Plan Bay Area, back on May 17th at a joint meeting of the ABAC Executive Board and the MTC, they unanimously adopted the draft preferred scenarios, the land use and transportation components, and the ABAC Executive Board also released the draft regional housing needs allocation methodology. So in terms of next steps on the former, this Friday at the joint MTC Planning and ABAC Administrative Committee, staff is going to present some EIR alternatives, and when I say alternatives, I mean ideas in terms of what the alternatives should be. Those will be released for a scoping session going forward, a number of meetings leading up to the July meeting. It'll be another joint meeting, the location to be determined. It's not going to be at the Oakland Marriott. It's not going to be in that room that some of you never got into or were into and had to leave. It'll be at another location, but it will be a joint meeting of the full commission and executive board. I believe it's July 19th. That's the third Thursday in July, where they will tell staff what we're supposed to do in terms of the EIR alternatives. And the staff reports are up on the website, so if you want to take a look at them in advance of Friday's meeting, please do so. We'll be really seeking a lot of input in terms of how they should be structured and what the agency should be looking at. And also at that meeting, the final RENA methodology will be adopted. We have a 60-day comment period right now. We very much appreciated the input, particularly of the Housing Methodology Committee. And, you know, we're looking for input from jurisdictions and stakeholders and so forth in terms of how to proceed. So with that, we'll move to our first of two items. The first item is, as I mentioned, discussion. We're going to focus on affordable housing and housing development as we move forward with implementation of the plan. If you have had a chance to look at the Jobs Housing Connection strategy, you'll see there are a lot of policy ideas that are included in the document that was released in May. We recognize there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of policy implementation in the region. We've lost redevelopment. We lost our primary source of affordable housing funding. We are looking at some major demographic changes through the next 30 years that we think bode well for a more focused growth pattern, but we also have some real challenges in terms of cost, implementation, the fact that we will still, based upon the income growth that we expect and the types of jobs we expect to come to the region, we still will have a lot of very low and low-income people in this region who will need housing, as well as moderate-income households that are oftentimes priced out of housing close to work. And that, in a lot of ways, is what we deal with a sustainable community strategy in this region, is how do we align these things better. In particular, we're going to need more multifamily housing, more rental housing, and roughly half of new households are projected to be very low or low-income household households in the future. So it's a pretty daunting task. But with that daunting task, I'll turn it over to Jeff Levin, who is the housing director for the city of Oakland. Jeff's been very involved in this group, served on the housing methodology committee, is usually a real source of wisdom around these issues in a calm way, which I find very helpful. So Jeff, welcome.
Thank you and good morning. Since I wasn't actually expecting to be the keynote speaker, the balance of time this morning will be weighted more in favor of discussion. So what I want to do in my presentation is frame some issues and put some questions out there, and hopefully we can have a discussion about how we're going to take on some of these challenges, because I think we're facing some really difficult ones in the intersection of timing between what's happening with the plan and what's happening in the funding world is less than advantageous. Let me start by saying, when we set out to develop the SCS, however long ago that was, we did establish a set of goals and performance targets, and I really want to start there and remind us what the housing-related goals were. Goal number two was adequate housing, and the specific target was to house 100% of the region's projected 25-year growth by income level, meaning very low, low, moderate, and above moderate income, without displacing existing current low-income residents. And I want to stress both parts of that, because both the production and the anti-displacement portions are key to this goal. Goal number seven, equitable access, also relates to housing. The target there was to decrease by 10% the share of low-income and lower-middle-income residents' household income that's consumed by transportation and housing combined. So the idea is to get the housing transportation bundle to cost less, particularly for lower-income households. So I think this poses several challenges for us. First, we need to ensure, as provided for in the housing element law and in SB 375, that we plan to accommodate enough housing to capture all household growth in the region, and that we do so by ensuring that there's zoning at adequate densities to accommodate affordable housing, which for low-income and very low-income households will be primarily multifamily rental housing. So part of the exercise in housing element is making sure that we actually get zoning at densities that make it possible for people to build affordable rental housing throughout the region. Second, we want to ensure that adequate housing opportunities for lower-income households are made available in the many transit-oriented developments that we're now planning over the coming decades. There needs to be equitable access to TOD throughout the region, and so we need strategies that are targeted specifically to making sure that as we build these new neighborhoods and new communities around transit, that we're making sure that we have ways to include all income levels in that and don't create pockets of gentrification around all of our transit stations. And that leads us to our third challenge, which is to identify and implement anti-displacement strategies so as not to displace existing low-income communities and communities of color. Achieving these goals requires some recognition that within the SCS, not all places are the same, and there is no one-size-fits-all strategy. We're really going to have to come up with a menu that jurisdictions can choose from and that the region can choose from so that we make these goals a reality. There are a lot of ways that we can conceptualize those differences. We've seen the place types, for example, in the SCS itself. But there's a distinction that I think is important for housing policy and one that we've been discussing throughout this process, and that's the distinction between communities of concern and communities of opportunity. So we speak of communities of concern. These are relatively lower income communities, higher concentrations of low income, generally higher concentrations of people of color, particularly around the transit stations, where part of the concern is the high risk of displacement. We know from what we've seen elsewhere in the country and around the world that when you do intensive development around places like transit, you change the housing market. And absent some kind of intervention, there are strong upward pressures on housing costs that do lead to displacement of lower income residents over time. And so to avoid the classic pattern of gentrification and displacement where we improve the neighborhood but at the expense of the existing residents, we need to make sure that we build anti-displacement strategies into what we're doing. The other side of this is communities of opportunity. More affluent communities, which tend to have lower percentages of low income and persons of color, where what we're actually trying to do is provide equitable access, and where the development of transit-oriented development in those communities actually provides us with the opportunity to open up those housing opportunities in a way that they may not have existed before. And I think it's particularly important that we do this around transit, given the goal of trying to reduce the housing and transportation cost bundle for lower-income households. We really need to make sure that we're siting affordable housing close to transit. What we don't want to see is some sort of pattern where we push lower-income households who are more dependent on transit away from access to transit. Even if we end up building affordable housing somewhere, if they're further away from transit and become more automobile dependent, we won't achieve our equitable access goal. Unfortunately for us, on the funding side, and you know, we all know that for affordable housing, funding is key. There's a tremendous gap between the amount of debt financing that rental housing can support, given the restricted rents that we are shooting for, and the actual cost of development. And that gap is filled by a multitude of public and private funding sources, many of which, unfortunately, have disappeared in the last year. And I want to highlight three of those. The first is that in 2006, the voters of California passed Proposition 1C, which approved over $2.1 billion in bonds, primarily for housing activities throughout the state. And key programs in here included the Transit-Oriented Development Program, the Infill Infrastructure Grant Program, and the Multifamily Housing Program. Thousands of units were built with this money, a lot of it around transit. There are some excellent examples around the Bay Area of how this money was used, projects that wouldn't have happened, inclusion of affordable housing in larger transit-oriented projects that wouldn't have happened without that money. That money is now exhausted, and the prospects for the passage of another housing bond in California in the near or even medium future are very bleak. We've relied multiple times over the last couple of decades on these one-time bond measures to fund housing. It's a struggle every time, and in the current fiscal climate, it's pretty unlikely that we're going to see that kind of bond measure, and it does lead us to look for other housing sources. The second, of course, is the loss of redevelopment, and this is really massive. Redevelopment captured roughly $5 billion a year statewide in tax increment financing. And under state law, at least 20% of that money had to go for affordable housing. So we have lost a funding stream that produced $1 billion a year in funding for affordable housing. That's in 2 years, that produces as much money as a bond issue that we're lucky to get every 5 to 10 years. It was by far the most important source of funding for affordable housing in the state, and with the demise of redevelopment, it is leaving a very large hole in our ability to finance affordable housing. That money also played a second and very critical role. It was locally controlled funds that were often allocated and committed to projects very early on and played an absolutely pivotal role in allowing developers to go out and leverage all the other sources of funding that they need in order to make affordable housing work. Projects take 3, 4, 5, 6 sources of funding. One of the most important is low-income housing tax credits, and over the last several years, the critical determinant of whether you get tax credits for a project has been the level of local funding for the project. Without redevelopment, that's really going to require rethinking the whole tax credit market allocation system, because that local support just isn't going to be possible. The third is developments in Washington, which is that the two key programs, block grants to localities that have funded housing, the Community Development Block Grant Program and the HOME Program, have suffered a series of cuts over the last several years. CDBG has been cut by maybe 20 to 25%. The HOME Program has been cut by up to 50% over the last several years. There was a rather devastating set of articles in the Washington Post a couple of years back. Some enterprising reporter took it upon herself to expose the abuses in the HOME Program by highlighting the worst 1% projects she could find and making them typical of the entire program. And unfortunately, that is driving the entire policy discussion around the HOME Program in Washington right now. And we're seeing a lot of changes on the regulatory side and huge cuts in the funding. So we've lost federal funding, we've lost redevelopment, we don't have any more bond funds, and we're trying to take on a new endeavor to come up with a much more sustainable and equitable growth pattern for the Bay Area without having those funding tools. So let's look at some of the things that are still available to us, both locally and regionally. Let me start on the anti-displacement side, and I'm just going to run through some possible tools. I do want to point out to folks, ABAG a couple of years ago did a study on development without displacement that goes through a number of great case examples and has a number of policy suggestions on how to do this. It's available on ABAG's website, and I really would encourage people to look at that because there's a lot of good work that went into that. So some of the tools that have typically been used to try and prevent displacement of existing low-income populations include condominium conversion controls, primarily restrictions on the number of units that can convert, as well as some kind of fee on condo conversion that can be used to fund affordable housing. Despite its rather controversial nature, I would say rent control has played a very important part in avoiding displacement of low-income households where it exists, at least for existing tenants. One of the drawbacks to rent control law in California is under state law, when units are vacated, the controls are lifted until the next tenant occupies the unit. Then controls are placed back on the unit for that tenant. But every time a unit turns over, it goes to market rate. And so over time, because there is natural movement within the rental housing, you still see rents moving in the direction of market rate, even where there is rent control in a jurisdiction. That needs to be paired with eviction controls, laws that are typically known as just cause for eviction laws, because without that, the way that owners get around rent control and are able to move their rents to market rate very quickly is by evicting tenants for no cause, which under California you can do with 30 or 60 days notice. Just cause eviction laws restrict evictions to legitimate causes, non-payment of rent, substantial violation of the lease, illegal activity, that kind of thing, but protect existing tenants against arbitrary eviction and displacement. Preservation of the existing affordable housing stock is going to be particularly important. This is an issue in the housing world that we've been dealing with for a couple of decades now as various funding programs reach the end of whatever regulatory restrictions were placed on housing, whether it was through federal programs that had below market loans where the option to prepay the loan and terminate the restrictions exists, whether it's the termination of Section 8 rental assistance contracts, the end of the tax credit compliance period, especially on the earlier tax credit properties. And now there's sort of another wave that we're going to be looking at over the next decade. The requirement for the low and moderate income housing set aside kicked in 1986. And by 1988, I think all redevelopment agencies had to have a low and moderate income housing fund in place. For many years, the restrictions on rent were 30 years. They were later increased to 55. But for projects that were developed in the late 80s and early 90s, that means over the next decade, we will start to see those projects reach the end of their restrictions. The loans that were made on those projects will come due, and it will take some political will to have those funds rolled over on the existing projects, the use restrictions extended, and in many cases there will be need for investment and capital improvement on those projects because the budgets and the financing for affordable housing, even where they include requirements for set aside of reserves for replacement, are never sufficiently adequate to cover all of the capital improvements that are needed, particularly when you get 20 and 30 years out. So this is going to be a combination of needing to extend the restrictions and find financing for the capital improvements. The need for that financing actually creates the opportunity to extend the use restrictions out for a much longer period and guarantee that the existing assisted housing stock remains an affordable housing resource, particularly in communities where we're seeing a lot of demographic change. What looks like a lower income community at one point in time looks like a mixed community some years later, and absent these protections ends up looking like a much more affluent community. Preserving the assisted housing is actually a way of preserving the diversity of income within a neighborhood. And finally, I think we're probably going to be seeing more efforts to look at acquisition and rehab of existing housing. One of the forms of financing that is still available is tax-exempt bonding with what are known as 4% tax credits. They're worth less than the credits on new production, but it's a very viable source of funding. Has the added advantage that if you're allocated the tax-exempt bonds, you get the tax credit allocation automatically. This doesn't provide 100% of the financing for a project, but it does go a long way, and I think we will see more efforts to acquire existing housing in areas where we know that TOD is going to be happening some period out in the future. The time to do this ACT rehab is now, before the property values start to change in anticipation of that development or in response to those developments going in. It tends to be very important to get in early to do the affordable housing piece, and frankly, going in and acquiring and improving the housing stock in an area and having some investment taking place, even though it's in affordable housing, actually tends to be a signal and an encouragement to private investors that the time is right to come in and do the market rate piece as well. It's often very difficult to attract market rate developers to areas that have seen significant disinvestment over a period of time, and things like ACT rehab for affordable housing can provide the bridge that gets us to the market rate housing as well. So let's switch over to the other half of this, which was new production and inclusion of housing in TOD. Inclusionary housing continues to be an important tool through inclusionary zoning. We are faced with some significant challenges on that. The Palmer decision several years ago has restricted our ability to do inclusionary zoning for rental housing. In short, the law held that inclusionary requirements for rental housing run afoul of the state's rent control law, which prohibit you from putting any kind of rent restrictions on newly produced housing unless there's some quid pro quo with the developer. So unless a jurisdiction is also providing some sort of financial assistance, you cannot just require the inclusion of affordable rental units in a rental project. So far, this has not extended to ownership housing, and so it is still possible on condo developments to require inclusionary housing. There was just a court case in San Jose that challenged their affordable ownership requirement. We'll see what happens with that. Some of the attorneys I've talked to are cautiously optimistic that that case is going to be overturned on appeal, but we'll need to wait and see. There are, within inclusionary housing, you can really structure that in two ways. You can structure it in a way that actually directly encourages developers of private market rate housing to put affordable housing into their projects. That has pros and cons. You get a mix of incomes within an individual development. But in home ownership developments, one of the things we found is that homeowner association fees tend to rise over time. There's no provision to protect low-income owners from those increases. So while the units may have been affordable when they moved in, as condo association fees start bumping up from $200 to $300 to $500 or $600 a month, you end up pricing out your low-income residents. So there are some challenges to actually achieving affordable ownership units within a market rate ownership project. The other way that IZ can be structured is through an in-lieu fee that basically says if the developer doesn't want to build those units themselves, then they can pay a fee in lieu of building the units. The money typically goes into a local housing trust fund and is then used by the jurisdiction to finance production of affordable housing. And it's really a fairly simple matter to decide which way you want to go. If you want the units produced within the project, then you structure the fee high enough that it actually outweighs the cost to the developer of building the units. If you want the money, you set the fee somewhat lower or sometimes even equivalent to the cost to the developer because just as a matter of convenience, it is easier for them to pay the fee than to deal with providing the affordable units. Where that happens within the large TOD projects that we are talking about, even if we do not do mixed income within the individual developments, I think we need to look very closely at making sure that within the project area as a whole, we get a mix. In Oakland, that has typically been our pattern. We've had political fights over inclusionary zoning for years, and so Oakland is actually one of the jurisdictions that does not have inclusionary zoning, but has provided in most of our large developments for the set-aside of some parcels within those developments for affordable housing. That was true at the Uptown project where we have Fox Courts right behind the Fox Theater. It's true at the MacArthur BART Transit Village. In some ways, it's true at West Oakland and Coliseum where essentially we went in and redid the public housing projects that were in those areas and actually added additional affordable housing. And I would say that this is actually a case of trying to improve the existing stock and provide the affordable housing as an incentive to get the private development to come into areas that have been long neglected. Some other tools that are available, density bonuses. California state law actually requires that cities provide density bonuses to developers where they get an increase in the allowable density on a project in return for providing affordable housing units within that project. And they're entitled to additional incentives beyond the density bonus because the density bonus alone actually doesn't offset the cost of providing the affordable housing, but it does help. Density bonuses work only where the zoning actually is set at a level low enough that developers want the density bonus, and it requires looking carefully at your zoning to see how it relates to what are some natural breaks in construction type. There are points at which you move from one construction type to another. We have wood frame or wood frame over a podium where you can go to four or five stories. Above that, you switch to mid-rise construction that uses more expensive reinforced concrete and steel. What you don't want is something that pushes developers from going from wood frame to the more expensive reinforced concrete as a way of getting a density bonus. It's not going to be very attractive to them because you're raising the per unit cost of development just by pushing them over. So it really helps to sort of look at what's the maximum density you can get to within wood frame construction. And I would argue set your density limits and your zoning requirements at a lower level than that, and then hold out the possibility of density bonuses incentives that can get them additional density without having to switch from wood frame construction to something more expensive. And I think we also find in a lot of places that wood frame construction, the 3 and 4 story over a podium, is a lot easier to get people to accept than the idea of having mid-rise and high-rise towers in their community. High-rise housing has not really caught on much in the Bay Area outside of San Francisco, and I think personally think there's plenty of potential throughout the region to increase densities with that product type, which is both more affordable and I think more amenable to the kind of pedestrian-oriented communities that we'd like to see in TOD. So it doesn't require that we build, you know, massive towers to incorporate this density. It just requires that we spread some of this out. And the use of density bonuses can be helpful in getting some affordable units into that. Commercial linkage fees. These are far less common than inclusionary housing, but there are communities, including San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley, that have them, and I'm sure I've omitted a couple. These are basically fees on commercial development, typically office development, sometimes other kinds of commercial development as well, that are basically mitigation fees that say that the creation of new commercial development creates new jobs that attracts new workers into the locality, some of whom will be low income. Many of the jobs that are being created pay at levels that still qualify people as very low and low income. And so the argument is that they're creating additional demand for affordable housing and should pay a fee to help mitigate the cost of providing that. Doing a commercial linkage fee requires a nexus study where you actually have to demonstrate the relationship between the project and the demand for affordable housing and make sure that the fee that you are establishing has some reasonable relation to the issue that you're trying to mitigate. But this has been going on long enough that there's plenty of models for how to do those nexus studies. They actually aren't terribly complicated to do. And they can be an important source of funding for affordable housing. Like the in-lieu fees in inclusionary housing, the fees typically go into an affordable housing trust fund, and the jurisdiction then allocates those funds for production of affordable housing. Because of some of the challenges to inclusionary housing, we have seen more interest in impact fees on market rate residential development based on an analysis that shows a connection between the development of market rate housing and the demand for affordable housing. It's a somewhat more complicated linkage than commercial linkage fees, but the basic idea is that if you build a lot of high-end market rate housing, you increase the demand in your jurisdiction for retail and services activity, which employs low-income people, which then creates affordable housing demand, and a number of cities have adopted residential impact fees for affordable housing, and several other jurisdictions are seriously considering it, given the legal challenges that have been posed to directly imposing inclusionary zoning. And finally, there's a variety of local housing trust funds that jurisdictions have established using a wide range of funding sources, hotel tax, transfer tax. I think each jurisdiction sort of needs to look at it. One of the advantages to a local housing trust fund is that if you have some dedicated source of revenue, then what you've got is a steady stream or a relatively steady stream of money flowing into your affordable housing trust fund, which then allows you to actually develop a pipeline of projects over time. And I think these sorts of trust funds could be very useful to jurisdictions. I don't think any of these tools on its own is going to be sufficient, but as those of us in the affordable housing world have been saying for years, it's an issue of making sure that we have more tools in our toolbox so that we can bring all of these together and find a way to produce affordable housing. So let me talk about a couple of things at the state level, because I think long run, without something to replace redevelopment, localities left to themselves are not really going to be able to substitute the level of funding that was coming from redevelopment, at least not for a very long period of time. In the short run, there is a battle going on in Sacramento right now to try and preserve unobligated affordable housing funds. The original legislation on redevelopment actually preserved the unobligated funds and allowed the successor housing agencies to keep those funds and keep doing affordable housing. As the legislation moved forward, there were some legal concerns about whether you could do that, so the language was changed to exclude the unobligated funds from passing on to the new housing agency, and now there's an effort to come back and fix that. The most active bill on this is AB 1585, which primarily deals with preserving this, but also has some other cleanup provisions on the redevelopment law. The fate of that bill is now very much caught up with the state budget. The governor's budget is looking to sweep those unobligated housing funds in some fashion. It's not entirely clear legally how that can happen, but looks to use those monies in some way to solve the state's fiscal issues around the next budget. So we'll see what happens with that, but you know, I would certainly encourage jurisdictions to look at that legislation and see whether your council or your mayor can support it. Because maintaining those funds not only preserves a pipeline of affordable housing, but deals with, I think, a much more serious concern, which is we've built an affordable housing industry, especially in the Bay Area, around nonprofit developers, and they depend for their existence and for the payment of their own operating costs on a stream of developer fees earned on new projects. When we stop the pipeline of projects, we're not just endangering our ability to produce affordable housing. We're endangering the financial health of these nonprofit organizations that now have a portfolio of thousands and thousands of units around the Bay Area. Some of us have dealt with what happens when nonprofits fail and fail spectacularly. It's a huge amount of work to come behind and try and figure out what to do with the failing nonprofit and how to transfer those assets to another nonprofit. So part of the reason that we need to hang on to these unobligated funds in redevelopment is because we need some way of bridging the industry itself until we come up with a longer-term source. So towards that, there was a bill that moved through the legislature this year, SB 1220. Which quite surprisingly made it in a very short time all the way to a vote on the floor. It did not get the required two-thirds vote that was needed, but a very strong campaign was built around the bill, and it will be coming back next year. And again, I would encourage jurisdictions to look at that legislation and support it. SB 1220 would establish a statewide document recording fee on real estate transactions that could generate somewhere on the order of $600 or $700 million per year in funding for affordable housing. So it doesn't get us all the way back to the level of redevelopment, but it could establish a significant source of funding, and one that is an ongoing stream and not a one-time source like bond financing. So one question I want to throw out, as we're moving into all of these new things, in particular as we are both looking at new state funding and looking at implementing the SCS and the new RENA, is do we need to begin to think regionally about how we are financing affordable housing in two ways? One is, do we need to think about developing a regional funding base, some kind of regional measure, whether that's through something like a sales tax or a regional bond issue or some other mechanism that actually establishes a regional pool of funds rather than asking each locality to have to come up with it on their own. And the second is whether, given movement towards things like SB 1220, do we want to look at some kind of regional distribution system for state resources for affordable housing? And I think in both cases, what we would be trying to do here is match resources to our regional plans and really sort of fulfill the promise that was made when we first came up with the concept of priority development areas, that we would try and find funding sources and direct that funding to PDAs so that those jurisdictions who have stepped forward and said, yes, we will take on more density, we will take on a larger share of the region's growth, that we reward that with the funding resources necessary to make sure that the affordable housing piece is included. So I really want to throw that question out in particular for discussion is how, whether and how we should be thinking regionally about the affordable housing delivery system.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much. Can we have a round of applause for Jeff? So we have close to a half hour for discussion before we get to the next item, and I think this is an excellent, it's a great presentation and overview, and I think that's a good question, a good way to kick things off, so open it up to folks. Evie has a big smile on her face. I don't know if she's going to hit her button.
Thank you, Jeff. That was a really excellent summary of kind of the situation.
And so, if people could just introduce themselves and who they represent.
My name's Evelyn Stivers. I work for the Nonprofit Housing Association of Northern California, so obviously care deeply about this issue. One of the things that I think is important to keep in mind as we start the conversation around affordable housing at the PDAs and the transit-oriented development areas, I think it's important for us to recognize that it's not just a matter of anti-displacement and making sure that it's fair, but it's also to make sure that our transit system actually runs well. What we've seen from studies all across the country is when you gentrify a community, the transit ridership actually goes down. And so we don't want to end up shooting ourselves in the foot by trying to, you know, increase the densities in these key locations and not putting in the right mix of incomes that actually support our transit systems effectively. So that's my only 2 cents.
Okay. Sir?
Hello, my name is Dwayne DeWitt. I'm from the Sonoma County Housing Advocacy Group, which was formed in 1996, and we've advocated for affordable housing in a method known as scattered site inclusionary, in which you try to get your affordable housing throughout the community rather dressed in priority development areas or in what we now are calling transit-oriented development. Sonoma County has a ongoing project known as the Sonoma Marin Area Rail Transit. It will have a number of stations, and these stations will be modeled on the idea of transit-oriented development. My hope is that you folks would give direction along the lines of the questions asked by Mr. Levin about this regional distribution and making sure that you get affordable housing at each one of those station sites, and then at the same time make it attractive to other communities within the larger county to have this type of development occur. The discussion doesn't happen at the planning levels. It doesn't happen with the politicians. They're very short-sighted, if you will, and narrow-minded. Excuse my expression of those terms of these public servants. But when they see money coming from elsewhere and they see a way to go and get it, that makes them more forward-thinking, and they look on a wider picture. You folks can be the impetus for that. It won't occur unless it comes from a larger body saying, hey, here's an incentive for you. Here's how you can make this happen. During our 16 years of advocating for housing that's affordable to people of all incomes across the community, we have found it very difficult because of the, if you'll excuse the expression, I guess the best way to put it is the special interest of the nonprofit housing groups that have made money producing housing that actually is more expensive than market rate now. Up in Sonoma County, they've just built a large complex. The units cost $330,000 a unit, and they put like over 150 units out in a certain area where there's a large mass of low-income housing already. You can buy a house in the area for $185,000. So what's happening now is we're building more expensive housing that's supposed to be for the more affordable, and it's actually more costly to the taxpayers. So I'm hoping you folks will take that on also and say, wait a minute, let's find a way to make sure we don't have all of this affordable housing all centered in certain areas that then continue to be low-income areas. I actually like the idea of neighborhoods improving. The word gentrification is not all bad. It's good to have us get out of ruts, if you will, and for those low-income people such as myself who came from the wrong side of the tracks, I'm glad my old neighborhood is improving, and so are the people that live there now. So thank you very much for your time, and please help Mr. Levin get those regional thinking ideas actually happening. Thank you.
Thank you. Parissa?
Parissa Fatehi Weeks, Public Advocates, and I thanks Ken and Miriam for kind of having Jeff give such a useful overview. And I think I might have missed sort of the context for the conversation in terms of what that kind of overview and that kind of thorough summary of all the policies that would be useful, what are we doing with that today, and what, how does that influence kind of some of the still somewhat open policies like the RENA methodology, the EIR alternatives, and any details on the One Barrier Grant program that may still need to be resolved?
So I think, well, it's really twofold. One is looking a bit further afield and down the road in terms of implementation of the plan that, you know, we do have some components that are underway or that have been adopted. You just, you know, named a number of them in terms of, in particular, the One Bay Area Grant includes funding to support PDAs. It has a basic structure to do so. I think arguably it's a significant step forward for the region. It encompasses a component known as a PDA growth strategy that calls upon CMAs to work with local jurisdictions and the regional agencies around how the funds might be implemented over the next four-year period. Expands funding for a PDA planning grant program. It also includes some funding for local jurisdictions that are taking on significant housing need to do additional planning. And expands funding for the TOD Affordable Housing Fund, which is an effort that MTC provided seed money for 2 years ago. The commission kicked in $10 million. That brought $40 million of outside funding. That's proposed to be expanded. So I think from our perspective, these are good starts. They're considered to be pretty innovative efforts, relatively speaking, when compared to regions in the state and nationally. But given some of the challenges that I think Jeff did a really excellent job outlining, they're not nearly enough. And no matter what we do with the RTP, it cannot bear the freight of the loss of redevelopment, the challenges of implementation in some of our key communities that have really good transit and have capacity for growth and have enormous challenges. And so part of what we outlined in the Jobs Housing Connection strategy were policy ideas. A regional housing trust fund, for example, is one that I think is salient to a number of people as something that's potentially a good idea. And we wanted Jeff to come and share his knowledge of some of the challenges and so forth and try to start moving us from, you know, scenario adoption to how will we actually implement this plan.
Given that the RENA methodology adoption or finalization is coming straight ahead pretty quickly, I wonder, Jeff, if you could speak a little to the principles you just gave an overview of and how we could make sure that in the decision making around the RENA methodology, we're handling the challenges appropriately.
Well, I think there's two sides to that. One is to make sure that the final RENA methodology adequately addresses its principal reason for being in the law, which is to assure a fair distribution of affordable housing throughout the region in a manner as consistent with the SCS as we can get. I think we want to avoid concentrating affordable housing only in places that already have provided the region's lion's share. So when I'm talking about the need to start thinking regionally about housing funding, it really is in part about trying to come up with a funding mechanism that does provide incentives and resources. One of the things that many jurisdictions have said is, well, we don't have the same resources that some of the big cities have, so we can't provide the affordable housing. But what if we came up with a regional housing trust fund and said that funding will follow the SCS and the RENA so that we will actually provide the tools for implementation, so that we have plans that aren't just wishful thinking about the development pattern we have, but actually have the capability to be implemented in a meaningful way.
Thanks, Ken. Bob McCauley with the Solano Transportation Authority. Since with the RTP, we're really talking about transportation-related and very much transportation-restricted funding, CMAQ, STP is our primary funding sources. What are some of the things that we can use those funds for that you think would actually impact the construction and the location of affordable housing?
Well, first I'll confess I'm not an expert on transportation funding, and I think that's been part of the process we've all been going through here is sort of the housing world and the land use world learning transportation and the transportation folks learning housing and so on. So I will say that to the extent that we have discretion, and I think over time as we're developing our transportation strategy, linking it to plans for development of complete communities that include the mix of housing for all income levels. We have scarce resources. We're never going to have enough money either for all the housing we need or all the transportation that we need to do. And I think within those constraints, it certainly makes sense for us to say that we'll put some conditions on the allocation of those public resources to make sure that we're achieving the goals that the region has set for it. So, to the extent that we can direct transportation funding in ways that supports the PDAs and in particular supports those PDAs that are doing mixed income housing, I think that that's a way that our transportation funding can help support affordable housing.
So it sounds like kind of second order effect is what you're looking at on there. My other question is related to the kind of the non-financial choices that are used when people decide where to build affordable housing. And assuming that the economy is better and people are actually starting to decide to build housing and affordable housing, what are some of the other factors that are really decisive in where an affordable housing project is built? Is it proximity to jobs? Is it quality of schools, access to parks, access to transportation? What drives those decisions in your experience?
Well, I may defer to some of the other housing folks on some of this, but frankly, the availability of land at an affordable price, a community that is actually zoned at appropriate densities that make it possible to do affordable housing, the availability of financing, I think those are three primary factors. There are a whole host of other issues, and we've all used a whole bunch of tools in our housing allocations by awarding points for certain kinds of things for years. Locally and statewide, funding programs have actually sought to give priority to funding projects that are located close to transit, that have access to other amenities, shopping, healthcare services, that sort of thing. But I think availability of sites, the zoning, funding, and frankly, just the political climate in the jurisdiction and how welcoming or not welcoming they are to affordable housing. It's very expensive to spend a long time in a big fight over the siting of affordable housing, and a lot of developers will just move on to communities where it's easy to move forward. Nonprofit developers face the same issues that for-profits do. Time is money. The more time it takes to move a project forward, the more expensive it will be. So I would add that just the local political climate around affordable housing is extremely important.
Linda and then Martin.
Jeff, like you, I kind of made the switch to the dark side, so I did land use planning and housing planning for a city that is Linda Jackson from the Transportation Authority of Marin. For a city, and now I work for a transportation authority, so I'm kind of getting a picture on both sides. And I think I want to speak a little bit to the, Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose, their issues in the local context are quite different from each of the other 98 cities in, in the Bay Area. So I just want to share a couple others. I'm glad that my PDAs, that I have two jurisdictions in Marin, have pretty much discussed during their housing element development all of these ideas. So, and I think most of the CMA planning directors will find that they have been debated locally already. And I wanted to share a couple others that folks might want to consider that might be more applicable. Is that the city I worked has 60,000 people, which in Oakland might be an area or a neighborhood, but that's the whole community on down. So in terms of occupancy, that's another big issue. So if there's a very robust code enforcement program dealing with occupancy, that can affect low-income households that may be doubling up and sharing rent that way and finding affordable housing that way. In terms of displacement, that can be, in a smaller community, can be a killer for housing. So you actually can have anti-displacement, but then you'll never have a developer looking because they can't. We have in smaller communities a different kind of developer, and they don't have those kind of resources to cover the anti-displacement factors. But what we have in Marin in some of our communities is requirement to help fund relocation of residents so that if they are losing their apartment because of redevelopment, they have assistance to move out and find a new place. So that's one way to do it rather than just prohibit it or make it prohibitive. Another one with rent control, that's been a long discussion, and with the smaller community, again, it's very it's difficult. Everybody knows everybody, so it's difficult to impose that kind. And there are market pros and cons to rent control, as you know more better than I do. And what has happened in a small community is to come up perhaps with almost a peer pressure kind of monitoring of rents that where everybody knows each other, they're able to say, okay, we realize things are getting kind of out of control, and we're going to be watching that. So that's been effective, I think, in keeping rents going when they were going up, rather than having outright rent control. Infill mixed, having units built, affordable units built in a project, works very well in the communities that I'm aware of. So whereas maybe in Oakland that doesn't work, In San Rafael, it's one of the successes. And when it was only affordable in Novato, they've had some problems. So, again, that's a local context approach. And I think rather than if it's all based on in-lieu fees, well, you really don't get a lot of in-lieu fees when you're a smaller community, enough to build the kind of housing. If you're a larger community, you would over time get some. So that's another local context thing to be thinking about, whether to be mandating it has to be offsite or can be inclusionary. I don't think that's what you're saying, because it's great to hear what Oakland's doing and been successful with. And then finally, we have to be really careful, having worked in a pretty high-income neighborhood community and in a county, that you don't kill the developer, because they're the ones who are building the housing. and putting on all the fees can actually end up being prohibitive, especially given the regulatory climate. And I know you didn't talk about the CEQA changes that are the infill exemption is really helpful, but there cannot be enough CEQA for promoting housing construction in appropriate places, in the right places, in urban communities. And so in terms of your question that you asked about distribution of regional funds, we have RENA distribution. And that is giving everybody their what they should be planning for affordable housing. And in a way, I would suggest that's your formula. Because just as the larger city, the three largest cities are taking the bulk of the housing and the affordable housing, but all the cities have that. And for those that have affordable housing responsibilities, and for those that do and that have to rezone, there's a major expense in the CEQA requirements for their general plans. And that's where that money can help go for, to address the CEQA issues so that the zoning can happen, so that the housing can be built for all the jurisdictions, regardless of their size. So I just throw that out as an option for your question.
Just respond briefly. I think those are very thoughtful comments, and I just want to reiterate what I said at the beginning, which is there is no one-size-fits-all policy. And the reason I sort of ran through this long list is because I think each jurisdiction, through its housing element process, needs to sit down and look at what are the appropriate tools and policies for achieving the housing goals in their community, given their community politics, given their market situation, and so on. So I would never prescribe a single policy. I think my point on inclusionary zoning was you can structure it one way or the other depending on what outcome you want. I'm not advocating that people take one route or the other. I think that needs to be a decision that's based on local conditions. I'm glad you brought up the CEQA issue. This is actually something we were discussing yesterday. Frankly, it would be really helpful to expand the infill exemption. This is particularly an issue in the larger cities where the thresholds for the exemption just aren't high enough to match the projects we're building. We need a level that's much higher than 100 units. The other issue on that is SB 375 had some CEQA streamlining measures built into it for situations where localities are doing things that are consistent with the regional plan, and I think we need a lot more of that, including a recognition within CEQA that there may be increased local environmental impacts as a result of individual projects that are built consistent with this kind of concentrated development strategy, but that those are outweighed by the far more important regional environmental benefits that come from a sustainable development pattern. So we know that if localities build much higher density, they're going to have some local traffic issues, for example. The question is, do we look at that in isolation, or do we weigh that against the reduction in regional congestion, the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, and so on? And I think it would be very helpful for us to push for a broader CEQA exemption or streamlining that takes into account projects that are fully consistent with the regional plan, that are in a priority development area, really should get a different kind of consideration because they're trying to address regional goals, and those benefits outweigh some of the smaller local impacts.
Martin, do you want to take the last
question? Yeah. Thank you, Ken. And thank you, Jeff. Martin Engelman, CCTA. Thank you, Jeff, for your excellent presentation, and thank you for decoding the language, because some of us are in transportation, and we hear those terms all the time, but it's nice to hear a very clear explanation of what each of them mean, so I appreciate that. You're talking about affordable housing, and I've always thought affordable housing was rental housing, but the Bay Area is very affluent, and so in Contra Costa we did have affordable housing that was actually purchased. But I always wondered why anybody would want to purchase something that where the value was locked down forever and you never got any appreciation on it. And a lot of people actually got burned on that because they sat there, their houses didn't appreciate. Well, if they had bought the same price housing somewhere else, they would have tripled their money, at least until the 2007 recession. But that's where my question's about, the 2007 recession, the Great Recession. My understanding is that when a developer looks at an affordable housing project, they make a calculation for the present value of the rent. There's this monthly stream of money that comes in, and that interprets into some kind of a present value, a discounted present value. And with the Great Recession, there was a lot higher unemployment among blue-collar folks and manufacturing folks than there was among white-collar. The white-collar was hit as well. So I assume you have your finger to the pulse on this. What happened to that present value calculation for affordable housing? If a developer looks at a rent stream now, is the present value of that lower based upon what happened with unemployment and all the defaults and I assume evictions that occurred from that? Or is the present value exactly the same as it was 5 years ago before the Great Recession? Is that affecting, adversely affecting, you know, how the thing pencils out?
I don't fully know, and part of the issue is that that present value calculation depends not only on the rent stream, but on the discount rate that gets used, and that fluctuates depending on market conditions and alternative investment possibilities and so on. I will also say the calculation's very different for a market rate developer and for a nonprofit that is doing an affordable housing project. They're not looking at the present value. They're looking to see whether, given the restricted rental stream, which means there's a limited amount of money that they will be able to get from conventional mortgage financing, can they fill the gap between what they can get in mortgage financing and what the project's going to cost? And that gap can be significant, on the order of a couple of $100,000 per unit, depending on what level of affordability you're trying to achieve. That's where all these public programs come into play, because they provide financing in the form of grants, in the form of equity through the sale of low-income housing tax credits, or long-term deferred loans where there's essentially no payment required on the loan as long as the use restrictions are complied with. Market rate developers will do the kind of calculation that you talk about, but there's an important piece on that, which is what they do with that information is they look at, you know, the rental stream or the sales prices they can get. They look at the cost of development, and they're looking for a residual value for what they're willing to pay for land. And so I'm not sure we've seen all these effects ripple through yet. But in a depressed housing market, what you should see is some downward pressure on land prices. And then, you know, when you get into a boom, what you see is a rapid run-up in land prices, which actually is an argument for another strategy I didn't talk about, which is creating some sort of fund for land banking for affordable housing so that we can take advantage of low land costs and lock in some sites before we get into a situation where prices escalate and nonprofits who take a long time to actually close an acquisition deal find themselves unable to compete with private developers who will just step in and buy a site. So I think all of those are issues around changes in the housing market, but I'm not sure exactly what's happening to the specific calculation you're talking about.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeff. It's a very, very good discussion. We'll be bringing back more policy discussions to the group as we move forward in the months ahead. We're going to transition to the other item for today, and this has to do with two place types that were brought as new PDA, Priority Development Area place types. They were brought to the Regional Planning Committee back in March, and there was a comment on the part of quite a few citizens, some local jurisdictions, quite a few stakeholder representatives regarding these proposed place types for rural center priority development areas and employment center priority development areas. And the RPC members directed staff to go back and look at a number of issues related to these proposed place types. We've done that, and Mark Charette, a regional planner at ABAC, is going to give you an overview of what we're going to be recommending tomorrow, revised recommendations to the regional planning committee that will then, their recommendation will be brought to the executive board at that same July 19th meeting, the joint meeting of MTC and ABAG in July. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thanks. I think that the theme of moving beyond one size fits all is a really important way to start the discussion about employment and rural PDAs slash investment areas, as we're now going to propose moving towards. So the context for this discussion is the Jobs Housing Connection Growth Strategy, which I'm sure most, if not all of you, are familiar. And the key to that, to this strategy, is building upon focus by distributing more than 80% of new housing and 66% of new jobs over the next 30 years into PDAs, which occupy approximately 4% of the region's land. So this has the benefit of a relatively compact transit-supportive growth pattern while simultaneously protecting the agricultural open space and conservation lands, which are currently in our unurbanized area. And this really represents a departure from the historic growth pattern, which has made major incursions into these both economically and culturally valuable areas of the region. So what staff is proposing, to give you a highlight before we go into detail, is that the RPC and executive board adopt two new place types that will be described, that I'm going to describe in greater detail, the rural community investment areas and employment investment areas. These will replace the previously proposed rural town center, rural corridor, and employment center PDA place types, which were the subject of the discussion Ken was noting. So investment areas are going to play a unique role in the growth strategy. They're places in which regional benefits can be provided with targeted investments, but which are intended and expected to accommodate a lower level of growth than many of the PDAs. So they kind of have a different role in the overall growth strategy than the PDAs. And they're intended and designed to complement and strengthen PDAs rather than compete with them for growth. They'll play a key role in preserving open space, agriculture, and conservation lands based on their location in the region. So here we see PDAs, the map you just had, and now let's take a look at the location of the rural community investment areas and the employment investment areas. You can see that most of the rural community investment areas are in the North Bay, while most of the employment investment areas are in the South Bay, and there are other locations throughout the region, but really it's worth noting that the genesis of these types were discussions with jurisdictions in different parts of the region, and the desire by those jurisdictions and stakeholders to have something more tailored to the challenges and opportunities that they had in their communities. So if you're in Sonoma County, unincorporated Sonoma County, there really weren't any place types that were going to help advance what would support the regional growth strategy in those locations. So let's go into those rural community investment areas first. These are centers and corridors of economic and community activities surrounded by agricultural resource and/or protected conservation lands. They present an opportunity to preserve a rural character and scale while integrating a range of housing types, local retail, and cultural and civic activities. And in some cases, those are already in place. In other cases, local planning and targeted investment would help push that forward and realize that. So these are locations in which very limited growth will take place, but in some cases, there are threats to the natural and agricultural resources that drive the local economy. And these areas are concentrated, as noted, in the North Bay, with 5 in Sonoma County, 2 in Solano, and 1 in San Mateo. This includes several communities of concern. So let's zoom into unincorporated Sonoma County, and this will give us an opportunity to really look at the unique role that the rural community investment areas can play in achieving the Jobs Housing Connection strategy. So this is an area with a very light urban footprint. There are some surrounding open spaces which are already protected in perpetuity, either through a conservation easement or other mechanisms. There are other open spaces which are protected by policies which are relatively strong but nonetheless more malleable. And if we look at the location of the PDAs, these proposed PDAs, and I should have mentioned earlier that the guidelines that we're going to propose later, if adopted, would lead to some changes in the size of some of these PDAs. And we've already been talking with some of the local jurisdictions about how that might take place, but you'll see that shortly. So you can see here the way in which the limited growth is really focused within the existing urbanized area, and that helps reduce development pressure on the open spaces, conservation lands, and agricultural resources, which really are the core of the area's identity and its economy, as well as providing resources that people throughout the region enjoy, not only through our food, but also through, and then food security is a big issue there too, but also, you know, critically through the recreation and open space lands that are really important to people that live throughout the region, as well as draw visitors to the region. So let's talk about some of the changes. As Ken was mentioning, we did additional work. We went through the process of developing guidelines, which were relatively loose for the investment areas previously described as place types. And so for the rural PDAs, what we're proposing regarding the size is 20 to 160 gross acres. And what that does is really say we're looking at if we're going to support investment in these areas, priority investment in these areas, it makes sense to focus that into areas, into parts that are truly the town centers, places that are walkable, places that can benefit the surrounding communities, but really can create a critical mass. So that's what the basis for that is. And then also the new project density up to 1.0 FAR. So what that says is these are not going to be places where we're going to put in really strong intensive development. And this is actually consistent with the guidelines and zoning of most of the applicants. And then also the location. Previously, there was, I think, a pretty strong definition. Existing town centers or corridor, which are identifiable and not contiguous with another urbanized area. Also, that there be an urban growth boundary or comparable policy protection. But what we're adding, what we're proposing to add here, is that they be within the existing urban footprint. So this gets back to the idea that these prioritized investments are not going to support new subdivisions, for example. And then supported planning, there's an additional reference here regarding planning for affordable and senior housing. So regarding the funding opportunities, the proposal is that these investment areas would be eligible for the PDA prioritized funding, which is 50% in the North Bay counties and 70% elsewhere. But within that context, there would be some guidance regarding the types of projects. So it would be those that improve the pedestrian environment, enhance access for bicyclists and transit riders, provide innovative ways to reduce VMT, and really focus some mixed use to the extent it provides walkability benefits. And it's worth noting that kind of by virtue of their location and travel options, most of these rural investment areas were modeled as having relatively high GHG. So there is a benefit in that respect as well. Now moving on to employment investment areas. Employment investment areas are significant centers of economic activity that can be enhanced by local serving retail, pedestrian, bicycle access improvements, focused growth around stations, and last mile transportation solutions. Planning for the employment investment areas provides an opportunity to increase travel options for commuters, focus new jobs in locations accessible to the region's workforce, including transit-dependent households, and allow employees to walk to daytime destinations such as restaurants and cafes that currently require auto trips. So in addition to focusing new jobs, investments in these areas can significantly enhance access to places that already have a wide range of jobs. The growth strategy talks about focusing new jobs in locations that are either within PDAs, along transit, in other similar locations, but I think it's important to recognize that there are locations in the region which we can be relatively confident are going to continue to have development in the future, continue to have jobs. And so part of the thinking here is that we want to ensure that there's relatively high levels of access there and supporting investments that really focus on access, don't really focus on being able to build more development, because the development's kind of already happening, but increase the ability of people to walk to these locations and access them via transit and kind of solve the last mile problem. So you can see the focus here on the South Bay. And we look then at PDAs within walking distance of fixed rail. These employment investment areas have strong access regionally. You can see that there's a connection to fixed rail via VTA light rail, via Caltrain, via BART, including the new BART extension to San Jose. And so these are places where there's substantial new housing, and connecting that housing to these employment opportunities is critical. You can also see that there's also a substantial amount of low-income commuting, particularly into the employment centers in Sunnyvale. And then we can see the substantial amount of new housing growth in locations that are connected by transit to the employment investment areas. So before going into these details regarding the standards, I think it's important to note that, again, that really a lot of these places are transit adjacent as opposed to transit oriented. And so providing that last mile connectivity and focusing investments on those is really the critical area that provides a regional benefit. So in terms of transit service, these are the guidelines. This defines eligibility for an employment investment area. We already had peak headways of 20 minutes or less. We're looking at that being within a half mile of the particular parts of the employment investment area available for funding, for priority funding. And that can be both fixed rail service, bus, or if there's not that service within walking distance, at least shuttle service that's connected to fixed transit. So no change there. Land use mix, some additional detail beyond what was previously described as a greater intensity and mix of use, and that goes to office, research and development, and employees serving food, retail, and services. And those are those daytime uses that employees currently need to access by car most of the time. And then the jobs housing balance. This is where I think we also get to regional benefit. Previously, we talked about sufficient housing near employment centers to merit investment. This time, we're talking about having as a floor either a jobs housing ratio of 1.3 or less within the jurisdiction that is applying for the employment investment area. And of course, that's the regional average. Or a 2010 to 2040 growth of both housing and employment that improves their jobs housing ratio. So the effect of doing this was to make Mountain View not eligible for an employment investment area, but the other jurisdictions which previously applied able to get an employment investment area. And so, for example, Sunnyvale has a jobs housing ratio above the current regional average, but they're really moving strongly in the direction of a better jobs housing ratio. And so in terms of density, we looked at the previous standard of 1.5 FAR. We talked with a bunch of communities, particularly in the South Bay, about whether this was realistic, and we actually moved it to 1.0. The reason we moved it to 1.0 is if you're trying to move away from the real low-density, auto-oriented office park, the next step up is a 1.0 FAR development, and that's consistent with a bunch of different developments that are taking place throughout the South Bay. And really what we're trying to do here is make sure that we're consulting with the local jurisdictions and providing something that's actually realistic. So that 1.0 FAR applies to jurisdictions that are above the regional jobs housing ratio, so that will be applying to Sunnyvale in this case. So to wrap it up, in terms of the funding opportunities, employment investment areas will be eligible for competitive PDA technical assistance from ABAG and MTC. They will not be eligible for the planning grants. In addition, some of the projects in portions of employment investment areas served by transit that meet the guidelines will be eligible for competitive One Bay Area grant funding dedicated to PDAs. Again, that's the 70% of funding in the counties other than North Bay and 50% of the funding in the North Bay counties. These projects should support the overall PDA growth strategy by expanding access to employment opportunities for households that live in transit-served PDAs, particularly low-income households, increasing the labor pool available to employers, and reducing vehicle miles traveled. And potential projects, and these are just things we've kind of been kicking around through the PDA growth strategies. These will obviously need to be defined in much greater detail. But those include shuttles linked to nearby regional transit stations, complete streets and pedestrian improvements, and transportation demand management associations that would be responsible for administering TDM programs. And here you can see the PDAs and investment areas by county, and this is indicative of the fact that for Sonoma, as well as for Solano, and to a lesser extent, but certainly in terms of employment centers for Santa Clara, these are sub-regionally tailored ways of implementing the regional growth strategy. So with that, I think we can answer questions.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Linda?
Hi. Well, I think the rural community investment area is a great idea, and I'm glad to see the expansion also for the employment. I'm gathering these are not quite place types, but they're like place types. They're investment areas.
They would be place types.
Okay.
But there's PDAs. So we have PDAs and we have the investment areas, which are part of the overall regional growth strategy, in the same way that you have PDAs, and they are going to be part of that overall framework, but there's just a different role that they play than PDAs.
So I just have a couple of thoughts on the rural community investment areas, and Mike may have some follow-up on it, I don't know. But there is no density mentioned. There is a floor area ratio mentioned. In the place types, there's a density for, I believe, all of them of some sort. So that would be an important component to include. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether there'd be any thought about, considering them for village place type, because there are a number of communities in the Bay Area that are, for their size and their history and, they're smaller, that don't qualify for one of the place types that were developed earlier. And a village type of place type could meet that need. Now, the rural one, obviously, is intended for quite isolated, but it doesn't really define what that isolation is. Mm-hmm. It says it's by resource, surrounded by resource areas and agricultural and protected conservation land. So I'd imagine in Marin that could be Nicasio, for example. But there are, throughout the Bay Area, communities of 10,000 and under that might benefit from this kind of planning as well. So that's why I suggest the word village and expanding it.
I'll just follow up real quickly. As Mark mentioned, these were really born out of input we've received over the last couple of years from local jurisdictions. The rural center PDA, as proposed, was largely driven by concerns in Sonoma County, unincorporated Sonoma County, that they have a number of centers that really, a couple of them had been submitted as PDA applications, and they were rejected because they don't meet the transit criteria. And we've certainly heard from stakeholders in particular who have felt like, this would be watering down the PDA program, and that is a concern. I think, in part, what we're trying to do is to balance. Maybe if one person could turn off their microphone, we're getting a lot of ringing. Thank you. We're trying to recognize the fact that this is a big region, and I think many people believe that the PDA structure works quite well in many respects. They looked at the rural center PDAs and essentially said, I know what a PDA is, and that's not a PDA. And so the policymakers directed us to go back, look at these areas, come up with something that really recognizes what they are and what the intent is in terms of accomplishment. They aren't places, for example, where it's likely that counties would be investing substantial One Bay Area grant funds because they just aren't big places. On the other hand, they are communities where there is an intent to make them more walkable, to try to ensure that in the future as development proceeds, it's not auto-oriented development. And I think a really good example of these areas is the Sonoma Springs area just north of the city of Sonoma. It's a community of concern. It's a significantly low-income community. It's not a place where that has been easy for pedestrians to walk along what is a very busy road. And the county really wants to invest in that area, not in a way that it's going to mean thousands of additional units, but some additional development, but essentially trying to accommodate the existing uses as they proceed and make life better for the existing residents there. And they'd like some support to do so.
Well, in that regard, I'm just wondering if there might be a different approach to these two issues regarding employment and the rural investment areas, and rather than treat them as a different kind of PDA, but maybe think about it more as an investment strategy. It seemed like some of the characteristics that you were mentioning were things where it doesn't necessarily require some kind of place designation, but an opportunity for the region to make investments in order to complete those last mile links or get a lot of issues regarding mixed use in office parks is that local zoning regulations typically don't allow those kinds of mix of uses within the office park. So maybe working with the local communities to change your zoning regulations. So maybe it's not a place type designation with specific criteria about density and floor area ratio and other things, but maybe more related to particular types of investment that would provide funding to complete those links that would actually accomplish what you're trying to do, investments for sidewalks or better transit service or those kinds of things rather than a more of a geographic type designation.
Sorry, I think there will be, as part of the policy implementation for the plan, those sorts of issues will be things that we'll be taking on a broader level. I think relative to the employment investment areas, I know there has been some discomfort on the part of some folks regarding if there isn't housing being planned in these areas, why should they receive any funding at all? And I think, as Mark outlined, part of what we're trying to get to is to really try to address what is a really important planning issue in this region. We essentially introduced to the world the office park, and for better or worse, it's been replicated all over the world since. But if we're going to make those areas accessible for all types of workers, if we're going to reduce the amount of driving that is entailed with those areas, we really have to address the last mile issue pretty directly. One of the things that I don't think Mark mentions, that the other recommendation that will be going forward, and this is coming from the policymakers or some of them and being brought back to them as a recommendation, and that's that we have for the next 4 years until we update the plan, that we have a moratorium essentially on new PDAs and new investment areas. So those that are adopted at this point in time would be it for a while, because we have lots of them, and to really try to treat these initial investment areas as really a pilot to see what kinds of strategies are successful to address some of the issues you described, and then reassess as we are moving toward the update of the plan in about 3 years how we're doing with this structure and what might be changed at that point in time.
I want to just add one thing to that. There was other action that we are going to recommend that was not noted, but it relates to the guidelines, which is having Napa, downtown Napa, which had previously been proposed as a rural town center, be designated a transit town center. And that's because downtown Napa is not like the other rural town centers and actually has a much higher maximum FAR than what we were looking at there. And that's something that staff there were very, very comfortable with, and that's even what they suggested. I just wanted to, we talked to all the communities to consult them about these issues, and that was kind of the resolution that the folks in Napa reached.
I just wanted to echo what you just raised, Ken, which is I think we were in the first round of this proposal concerned about watering down the requirement for housing and really making new areas eligible for incentive funds, like, you know, the One Bay Area grant for areas that won't be carrying their share of the responsibility for housing responsibility in the region, a housing opportunity. And I guess now that One Bay Area grant eligibility goes to One Bay Area grant funding calculation goes to a full county or CMA without real firm requirements about how that will then go to a city, I think that connection continues to be diluted, and so we remain concerned about that lack of connection. And I just wonder if you explored at all One Bay Area grant fund eligibility being, you know, maybe the preferences that it goes to housing, even if some of these new areas are now in the eligibility pool, but is there a way to prefer? My whole takeaway from Jeff's talk this morning is that local governments need more help to build affordable housing, and this is sort of making that connection more tenuous rather than more firm.
As you know, One Bay Area grant, along with most of the rest of this, is new, and it's structured in such a way to really walk a line between flexibility, directing the resources and a lot of the decision making more to a local level and a county level, with some guiding policy at the regional level. And the intent behind a PDA growth strategy is to provide that envelope, but I think that a lot of the conversation does move to a county level and a county/jurisdiction level in terms of what are the funding priorities going to be, how do things roll forward, and, you know, we're committed to being helpful when asked for help in terms of how this will get implemented over time. But I think, you know, the formula is pretty clear in terms of how the funds roll forward to a county and the role that different jurisdictions play in essentially pulling funding to a county. I think it's going to have to be a discussion at a county level in terms of how things move forward. And we've put out some suggestions in terms of, you know, the types of projects that might be a good fit for these areas that are really scaled to or intended to address some of the last mile issues and accessibility and so forth. But I think what you're talking about is something that will be discussed as these as the One Bay Area grant funds roll forward and as the CMAs work with local jurisdictions on implementing that funding. Martin?
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for your presentation. I didn't get your first name. Is it Mark?
Mark.
Thank you, Mark. I actually kind of like the idea of adding these two place types. In Contra Costa, you know, at the risk of watering down the PDA, we actually have places like this, especially in the employment area, and but I think you might be a little overly optimistic if you think the barrier to increasing transit for those locations is the last mile, because essentially those areas are basically auto access. But I think there are opportunities in those areas to improve the walkability. I mean, that's probably the biggest barrier. We have a number of places, well, they're not place types yet, but areas in Contra Costa like this where you park your car on one side of the boulevard and do something, and you have to actually get in your car to go to the other side of the boulevard or get in your car to go down the street less than half a block because it's so unwalkable, and not to mention the parking restrictions and all that. So I think the opportunities here would be to think about, okay, we've lost the transit battle because transit in these areas is probably less than 2%, I would think. And you're talking about maybe you could get it up to 2.1 or 2.2%, which would be a huge victory, a 10% increase in transit ridership. It's very much on the margin, but where there is a huge opportunity is look at these areas and figure out how to make them more walkable so that people get there, they park, and then it's more of a place to be, it's more of a place to walk, and that really improves just the livability of the area if everybody can walk around it rather than come and go. But I want to direct this question actually to Ken, because at the beginning we talked about 80% of the housing going into PDAs and 66% of the jobs going into PDAs. Is there going to, for this RTP, once it's adopted in April 2013, is there going to be any kind of performance monitoring on whether or not you're hitting 80 and 66? And are you going to track that and report on that?
There is. What we're proposing is that in the interim years between the plan updates that we do, let's see, in 2014 and 2016, we'll be doing a housing report. So we'll be looking at permits in the region by income category and PDA, non-PDA across the jurisdiction, sort of similar to what we've done in the past but expanded. And we're going to try to monitor employment and housing and a number of other issues, including the performance targets and some other important regional issues that have been talked about a lot in meetings like this, but it's to be defined in a state of the region report. So that would come forward in 2015, sort of the interim right between the plan updates, to really look at how we're doing to inform both the analysis for the plan update and also some of the recommendations when we start launching into doing this all again. And I just quickly note, Martin, on the employment investment areas, the transit criteria I think is pretty key. These areas that have to have pretty decent transit service that's commensurate with the PDAs either have to have fixed rail or bus service of 20-minute headway or less or more frequent. So that's kind of key to this, to these areas. I think there are a lot of places in the region that are exactly as you described, that, you know, they obviously require a lot of work for people to drive less and meet those goals. We've got Nathan and Bob and Steve and
I'm still here, sir.
And Dwayne is in the queue as well. Thank you.
Okay. To some extent, this kind of looks like an issue mostly for the counties where these are being proposed, because it's their funding pools that are getting diluted, although some of the funds, the technical assistance funds and the planning funds, are region-wide, so that could affect everybody in the region. I guess one thing that concerns me about this as a concept is that the employment areas have to be transit served, but there doesn't need to be any direct or convenient connection between the employment area and where the city is building housing. I mean, the cities are getting credit if they're driving down their jobs housing ratio. That's good, but that could be 5 miles away. That could be, in some cases, 20 miles away and not really tremendously accessible to the employment area. So I think that's a problem. And just a technical note, it was a little unclear to me. In Santa Clara County, VTA is working on a bus rapid transit line along El Camino, and if that comes to fruition, I think you want to be sure to recognize those as transit stations, because that'll be a fixed guideway that's out there. Thanks.
Again, Bob McCauley, STA. A couple of quick things, then a question. I want to agree with Martin's comment that many of these rural or remote areas are auto-focused for especially their long-range travel, and transit isn't going to make much penetration in there, and that the best thing we can do is help bike ped for local transportation in there. I think that's a very key point. I think it's also important to recognize that these areas actually are critical to the viable agricultural economies that are out in those areas. There's almost no money to support the ag and open space. We know there's a $5 million project, a pilot for the North Bay counties for the PCAs and the ag areas. And I think this is one additional way of kind of recognizing how important these communities are to supporting the ag and open space that then is beneficial to the region. So I think that's a good thing for it. A specific question in looking at the funding opportunities for both these areas is I don't see local streets and roads investment operation and maintenance listed in there. And was that something that OU assumed or that you're specifically excluding local streets and roads operation and maintenance funds from eligibility for these two areas?
We're not excluding them or suggesting they be excluded. What we're suggesting instead is that, you know, the areas and the context of these areas, which you've outlined the rural areas, I think, pretty well, the rural investment areas, that they be factored into the growth strategies in terms of what's going to make sense, and that there are likely certain projects for the employment investment areas that would be really helpful. There are other things that wouldn't be, but it doesn't mean an omission of local streets and roads. One thing we are recommending is adjustments in the sizes. There was in particular concern about a proposed, when it was a PDA proposal, for the Midcoast PDA proposal in San Mateo County, which if you look at the map, it's really pretty large. And what we're recommending is that these areas really need to be centers, and they shouldn't be broadcast over areas that aren't appropriate for the designation. So I think that addresses concerns that we had about an inappropriate designation and how it might relate to spending a lot of funds on rural roads, which is not really the intent of the type of the effort. Thanks. Steve?
You mentioned that this was going to be a pilot program, and I knew it grew out of the concerns from North Bay communities and counties. But as this progresses, will there be an opportunity for other areas to possibly nominate rural development areas or employment centers? And, you know, one of the beauties of the Bay Area is that we are a mosaic, and I can suggest that perhaps we should be strategic about where we spend these monies. South Santa Clara County, Alameda County, East Contra Costa could all identify areas where they have villages or centers and surrounding that is agricultural areas that need to be preserved, particularly in Santa Clara County, where they've been working for years now on the Santa Clara Valley Habitat Conservation Program. Cities like Morgan Hill are surrounded and part of that, as is Gilroy, also surrounded by rural unincorporated areas that have lots of agriculture as well. So the opportunity to jump in later, perhaps, to be strategic and leverage some of this funding with maybe some PDA funding so that you get greater bang for your buck. And when and if that would be available. Now, $250,000 cap is not a lot of money. Not a lot of us are going to go chasing after that. But still, if it was leveraged, it could be potentially something that would help the PDA, the adjacent PDA.
Thanks. So, yeah, just to recap on that front, so the proposal is recommendation that these go forward given this framework, that we also have a moratorium on new areas. That doesn't mean that there can't be boundary changes and so forth for PDAs unless the boundary change looks like a new PDA, but that would be handled at the staff level. But we have this going forward, and we assess, and I think it's something we can begin to assess even in a couple of years to see what kind of effect these are having. I see we...
Yes, sir.
Go to you first, and then we'll take the last one.
My name is Dwayne DeWitt, and I serve as a community planner in West Oakland. 2 months ago, I was here, and I spoke about the possibilities of West Oakland being better served with your organization giving some futuristic planning approaches. I believe right now is an important time to point out that West Oakland, as a PDA, could be one of these employment investment areas. It's right next to the West Oakland BART station and existing transit, so you have an adjacency. And it's currently in process for a West Oakland specific plan paid for by Tiger II funding from the federal government for a predetermined new transit system to run through West Oakland, connecting Emeryville, the MacArthur BART station, and Oakland into West Oakland. So please, if at all possible, put this into your planning and let it be a part of the proposed sites that will not be a part of a moratorium. Let it be in there now, and then the people who are working over in West Oakland on the specific plan could know about this, if you folks could inform them, and they could get some technical assistance. Right now, they're still in that silo thinking that I mentioned 2 months ago, and they're having a public workshop on June the 12th, and I'm hoping that someone from your organizations could come there and tell them of this, because they don't listen to us public advocates. We're just burning up their time if they see it. But I really believe this is perhaps one of the ones that could be your jewel in the crown, because that area is slated for greater housing growth, and employment opportunities can exist there as they convert the areas that were former light industrial into new forms of employment. Thank you very much.
I guess we have our last question.
Okay. I'm Ellen Smith from BART, and I wanted to comment on the employment investment areas. Since it looks like it could be supporting an opportunity for more tech sprawl, I'm wondering if you could introduce a criteria for TDM into the four that you have in here so far.
In terms of recommendations of regarding how funding could be utilized in these areas, of the types of projects that would be funded?
Right.
Okay. I mean, okay, well, thank you very much for today's meeting. I'll just note that the July meeting is scheduled for July 10th, not the day before the 4th of July, which would be July 3rd. It's at 9:30. It'll be in this building. And again, Friday here, if you're interested, the EIR alternatives are going to be, in terms of the concepts, will be released at the Joint Committee. That meeting starts, I believe, at 10 a.m. And also the HUD Sustainable Communities Initiative Grant, which MTC and ABAG received funding for, a lot of work on the part of local jurisdictions and stakeholders on that, working in partnership. That's going to be presented in terms of what it is and what it's about. And it does touch on some of the affordable housing issues, a better understanding of displacement issues in the region and economic development. That's going to be presented to the Joint Committee as well. So encourage you to attend. Thank you very much.